So life is like a game of snakes and ladders, isn't it? It's full of ups and downs. And yet our experience of life, so they say, is based not so much on what actually happens to us, but on how our minds look on what happens. And nowadays, I think it's fair to say that the most common way of looking at life is to believe that it's all down to random chance. So despite that, and how often that sort of belief is usually kind of based, or at least claimed to be based, on rationalism and science and so on, it's remarkable how quickly it turns into superstition, isn't it? You know, how many people refer in the daily grind of life to mathematical, statistical probability? Not very many, but how many talk about, you know, lady luck and fate and fortune smiling on them or not? Or, you know, the universe wanting it to happen or such like? And why do so many ordinary, otherwise intelligent people touch wood, you know, as though somehow touching an inanimate object is going to make your good luck not turn too bad? My car mechanic did it the other week. We just had an actually pretty scary fault with our car repaired, and he said, it'll be all right now, touch wood. You know, didn't fill me with confidence. You can't put that in the bank, can you? Other people respond with a kind of a weary resignation, you know, the sort of c'est la vie, well, what will be, you know, nothing can alter it, nothing to be done about it, so why bother getting particularly sad or happy or excited, you know, it's just going to turn out however it's going to turn out, you know, why bother? And there's a kind of an optimistic version of that as well, isn't there, which is that it'll all turn out for the best, almost like I don't need to do anything, but it'll all turn out for the best. Now, how many parents say that to their children? You know, young people, I'm sure your parents have said that to you many times. You know, it may look bad now, but don't worry, it'll all turn out for the best. Just you wait and see. I'm sure I've said it plenty of times myself. And that phrase, it'll all turn out for the best, might even have originated from a verse in today's passage, Romans 8, verse 28. But what we need to realise is that our passage is about anything other than blind fate. The point is not that we're at the mercy of some random forces at work. The point is that behind this world, there is a coherent plan. The world, our whole world, is moving according to God's great big plan, and our lives are too. And the great theme of Romans 8, the whole chapter on the snakes and ladders board of life, is security. So verse 1 begins saying that there is no condemnation for Christians. And verse 39 ends the chapter by saying there's no separation either. The Christian cannot be separated from the love of God in Christ. So no condemnation, no separation. Those who are saved are safe forever. That's the point. And in the three verses we're mainly looking at, verses 28, 29, and 30, are three great assurances for the Christian. One we're going to spot in each verse. And essentially the message is this: don't touch wood, don't cross your heart, don't invest in a lucky charm bracelet, or please don't read the horoscopes. You know, instead of all that rubbish, put your faith, put your trust in the great big God of Romans 8 and his unstoppable plan. So the first thing we see, verse 28, is that God is working for my good. God is working for my good. And of course, this is a favourite verse of many Christians amongst us, isn't it? You know, you might even have it on a nice placard or a postcard or something at home or on your wall. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to his purpose. All things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. Who's this talking about? Let's be clear about that from the start. It can't be talking about everyone. It's talking about Christians. It's talking about people who are friends with Jesus, people who love God, who God has called to belong to him. How do I know I've been called? Well, because I love God compared to before when I was hostile towards him. So these verses, they're talking about friends of Jesus. And so what does it mean then that all things work together for our good? What does that mean? Well, let's break that down into two parts. Firstly, who or what is working in this? Your Bible, if you've got an ESV like mine in front of you, it'll have a couple of footnotes in that verse, a couple of sort of slightly alternative renditions. Point is, all of them are totally valid, but I think probably that the couple of alternatives that you get in the footnotes might be slightly better emphasis-wise than what they actually decided to go for. Because it isn't that the all things are working together for our good, as though, you know, that sort of going back to that superstitious idea that we began, you know, the mysterious workings of the universe, you know, blind fate, somehow all things are just sort of making everything turn out okay in the end. Because the Bible tells us, doesn't it, that this world did not come about by random chance. God made it. It came into being through an intelligent creator, God. That's how we were made. And the Bible tells us that God is king over all of his creation. God rules this world. He calls the shots. And God doesn't need to, you know, take a break, have a nap, or go on half-term holiday, leaving us kind of to the mercies of the wind of fate for a while. God is always at work. So it's not so much all things that are working, but God working in all things. So the other versions have it, God works all things together for good, or God works in all things for the good. So all things are working together for good, but as long as we realize it's God doing the working. By the way, this doesn't mean that God is responsible for evil or creates it in any way, but that's probably a conversation for another day. So if God is working, the next question is, well, what do we mean by good? What is our good? Who gets to define what is good? If it were up to you and me, we'd probably say our happiness, wouldn't we? Or our security, or our comfort, often parceled together. That's our greatest good. And we think that anything that gets in the way of our happiness or our comfort is bad, that it's something to be avoided. But the question really is, well, are we seeing the whole picture? And is our view the most valid view? As parents, we're just about at the point, particularly with, I'm going to mention him because he's here, Enoch, we're having to explain that it's not always the best thing to have chocolate ice cream and fruit juice with every meal. That would be the greatest good, wouldn't it, if you got to decide how things were. But we, you know, he has to trust that his parents know that that's not for his long-term best. And that's actually why I've got this stepladder here, just as a sort of visual reminder of, you know, needing a sense of perspective. Because essentially, what we see in life is we're on one square, and we only see the square in front of us, or two or three squares in front of us, and the you know, the ladder that we're climbing up, or the snake that we're currently sliding down. But the point is that God sees things very differently. And he is, he's a lot higher than I am, but he sees the whole big picture. He doesn't just see what we see right in front of us. He knows what he's working towards in all things. And actually, there was a quote in Discipleship Explored. I've done it again. Discipleship Explored 2 weeks ago in the video where Barry said, I think I've got this right, God gives us exactly what we would give ourselves if we ourselves knew everything that he knows. God gives us exactly what we would give ourselves if we knew what he knows. But God is working for my good in all things if I am a believer in Jesus. Secondly, moving on to verse 29, God is exalting Jesus. God is exalting Jesus. Now, you've probably, I'm going to pick some of those up in a minute. You've probably heard people use the illustration of life as being like a big tapestry. I know I've used it myself, and the idea behind it is that kind of at the moment we're looking at the back of the tapestry as it's being woven, and we can see all the, you know, the messy tangle of all these different threads that just seem like a complete jumble. But that one day, in the future, when we are in glory and we get to look back, we'll see God's point of view, as it were. We'll see the whole picture. And we're going to realize that all along this master weaver had a grand design. He was weaving all those inexplicable events of our lives into a beautiful tapestry of many colored threads. Now, I think that's a really helpful image, as long as, in connection with this, we realize that essentially the tapestry that God is weaving is not a picture of you or me with our thumbs up and a big cheesy grin on our face. You know, it's not all about us. That's the point. It's a picture of someone else entirely. It's a picture, as it were, of Jesus. That's what God is weaving. Now, here we go. Easy. I'm not even going to assign points for this. It's too easy a question. What's this? Who wants to shout out? What's that? The Mona Lisa. The Mona Lisa. Well, yes, but also, this isn't actually the Mona Lisa, is it? You know, the Louvre aren't going to let me go and hang that up this morning and borrow the other one that's in there. You know, this is just a cheap reproduction that I printed off my own laptop onto ordinary white paper. And you can buy cheap representations of the Mona Lisa on goodness knows how many different items of tourist tat everywhere in around Paris and probably all over other places too. But why is it, other than to cynically make money, why is it that people make reproductions of something, these tacky versions of the Mona Lisa? Well, up to a point, isn't it to publish the brilliance of the thing? You know, it says, every reproduction of it says that the real thing is superb, that it's worth seeing, that it's worth queuing up for hours outside the Louvre to see. And now Paul is basically saying something very similar here in Romans 8. He's saying, so verse 29, for here's sort of the explanation goes on, for those whom God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, in order that he, Jesus, might be the firstborn among many brothers. So what's his purpose? What is the will of God? Well, it's this. God is making Christians to be like Jesus. Not that we look like him physically, you know, like we look like a sort of a celebrity lookalike or doppelganger or whatever, but as a brother or sister of Jesus, with a character to match. That's what God is working towards. So he's using the ups and downs of life, as it were, to mold us, to make us more like Jesus. So that, in order that, this is the purpose, Jesus would be exalted, that he would be lifted up as the firstborn, the preeminent one of many brothers and sisters, so that Jesus is seen as the most important. Why? Well, look at all these Christians everywhere being made to look like him, like, you know, little copies, little reflections of Jesus. Well, how wonderful must the real thing be? That's the point. What is the good from verse 28? It's that we're made like Jesus, so that Jesus himself is exalted and everyone can see how great he is. The best thing, and I think it takes a big mind shift, doesn't it, to see it this way, the best thing that can happen to us is that Jesus' brilliance is proclaimed from the rooftops, that he is at the center of everything. And it's the glory, that's the glory that verse 18 was talking about, where Mary started reading for us, the glory that's not worth comparing with the present suffering. It's when Jesus is center stage. That's what is our benefit more than anything else. God cannot do anything better for me than exalting Jesus. That is my good. But then verse 30 then brings us, as it were, slightly back, inward looking just a little bit, as we see, thirdly, that God will certainly glorify me. If I'm a Christian, if I believe in Jesus, God will certainly glorify me. I'm going to read from verse 29 as well as 30. So we've just read, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. Now, the point of that verse, or those two verses, is that they're built around a chain. Sometimes, you know, it's called the golden chain of salvation. And it's an unbreakable string of five words. They're five big theological words. We don't need to, or we won't have time to look at them all today, but I'm going to stick them on the rungs of my ladder as we go along. So it says, firstly, that God foreknew. It's very helpful that the church opens a step ladder with five steps. Those who he foreknew, he predestined. Those whom he predestined, he also called. Those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. I think I've stuck them on in the right order. That's pretty important. But the point is, because they're also all in the past tense, that if God has started the first rung of this ladder with someone, then he's going to see it through to the end. You could almost say that kind of God's motto in this case is like straight from the quiz show Mastermind. You know, I've started, so I'll finish. That's the point. So in all of life's ups and downs, God is working it in the Christian to get us step by step to the top of the ladder. Except at the top of the ladder is not me or you, but who? You've guessed it, Jesus. There's a reason why he's the answer to everything. By getting us to the top, Jesus is exalted above us, in us, as the firstborn, the Son of God, in whom we are image bearers. Let me just sort of wrap this up by putting it another way. Did you know that, you probably do, that up until about 500 years ago, humans thought that the sun revolved around the earth and not the other way around? For thousands of years, people thought that we were at the center of the solar system. But then a guy came along called Nicolaus Copernicus, and he looked at the world differently. He saw something that no one else had seen up until that point. And he realized that the earth actually revolves around the sun. It completely changed the way we understand our place in the whole universe. The point is, we're no longer at the center where we thought we were. And that's exactly really what these verses are saying. It's not about us, it's about the sun. Except S-O-N, sun. Jesus the sun, not S-U-N, the sol at the middle of our solar system. We need a personal Copernican revolution to see our true place with Jesus at the center. It's only when Jesus is at the center when life makes sense. It's only when he's at the center that we find a healing for life's hurts. And it's actually when we put ourselves at the center and push Jesus out that then suddenly that tapestry suddenly gets torn and full of broken threads and unravel and fall apart. But wonderfully, far from this kind of undermining our happiness and our security and our assurance, it actually does the opposite. It assures it, doesn't it? Because God will certainly glorify Jesus. Of course he will. That's the whole purpose of history, is to glorify his son, Jesus. No doubt about that whatsoever. It's going to happen. And therefore, he's certainly going to glorify you and me, so that Jesus will be glorified in us. It is certain. So by seeking to put Jesus at the center and making the most of him and becoming more like him, we find far more happiness, security, and joy than we could ever find anywhere else. I'm going to pray, and I promise this wasn't a trick exercise that we did earlier, praying for the snakes and ladders of life, but what I'm going to try to do is to slightly turn our prayers and give thanks for what we've called the snakes in life as well as the ladders, and pray that God will use all of them, good and bad, to mould us to be more like Christ. So do I need you join with me as I pray, and then we're going to sing again and then come to our time of communion.